The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This is the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Hello, writers, and welcome to a third season of the Writer's Toolkit podcast, which has a single-minded focus this time: to empower playwrights. I'm shifting focus from writer-to-writer conversations to explore proactive strategies that can help us take control of our creative destinies. The mission is clear. How can we, as playwrights, move from a powerless position and seize agency over our work? So often it can feel that the gatekeepers of the theatre world hold all of the power and our success hinges on their approval. But what if there are more intentional and proactive approaches we can take than simply submitting to festivals and competitions? This season is all about uncovering those strategies, driving progress with our work and turning creative frustrations into actionable steps. I reached out to playwrights and theatre makers around the world who forged their own paths to the stage, the trailblazers behind playwriting collectives like 13P and 7On, self-producing writers and artistic directors at accessible fringe theatres. Conversations include all stages of new play development, from initial readings in their various forms to dramaturgy and production. So I hope this season will be somewhat of a game changer, offering tools, inspiration, and knowledge to bring your work to life on your terms. I hope the stories and insights in this new batch of episodes will serve as a valuable and inspiring resource for our playwriting community.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast with Paul Kalbergi.
In this first episode, I'm shining a spotlight on London's Camden Fringe Festival, renowned for its accessibility and support for theatre makers. Camden Fringe exemplifies how playwrights can find a platform that embraces new work and offers a direct route to audiences.
Coming up,
we'll hear from Zina Barry and Michelle Flower, the powerhouse duo who founded and run the Camden Fringe Festival.
Think about how you're actually going to reach people.
Yeah.
There's no point writing stuff if no one's going to come and see it.
Think about what the theme of your show is and who that's going to particularly appeal to.
I'm also joined by two talented writers, Pavan J. Singh and Valeria Sueste, who tell us all about the journey to stage for the exciting projects that they're bringing to the festival in August.
There's nothing we can do. If bombs start landing in your home country and tanks start rolling in, there's nothing you're going to do about it.
I don't think it's anyone's business whether at what age you lost your virginity or whether you're a sex addict or not. I mean, the play, it's obviously about these sort of things, but I think it's about finding connection, you know?
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Zina Barry is a Manchester-based festival producer and writer. Together with Michelle Flower, she's co-run the Camden Fringe Festival since its inception in 2006. They've also produced shows for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and managed London's Etc. Theatre, the birthplace of the Camden Fringe. Under their guidance, the festival has expanded to more than 300 acts across more than 20 venues, making it a cornerstone of London's theatre calendar. And Michelle and Zina have put together a wonderful resource with the Camden Fringe Pod, a podcast all about the Camden Fringe and beyond. And I kick off this episode by telling them what a treat it's been to listen to.
Oh, thank you.
Hooray.
That's good. It's nice to know someone's listening.
One or two people. That's pretty much it.
Well, for anyone who's not familiar with Camden Fringe and maybe is hearing about it for the first time, whether internationally or in the UK or in London even, could you give us a potted history of kind of how the Camden Fringe came to be and kind of where it is today?
So Michelle and I used to run the Etc. Theatre in Camden, and we ran that venue for years, and we used to take shows up to the Edinburgh Fringe as well in the summer. We always found it quite difficult to programme shows for August, but we still had all of the same costs running the venue. So we decided one afternoon that maybe we'd have a little Camden Fringe Festival and see if that excited people to come and do something. So we sort of did a shout out to lots of the people that we sort of knew anyway who were doing bits of work, and said there's going to be a festival, who wants to be in it? And sort of within like 24 hours we had 22 shows.
Wow.
Booked in. So that was the first year, and we didn't know how it would go. we went to Edinburgh that summer and left somebody else in charge. We had quite a miserable summer in Edinburgh. It was just very, very hard that year. And we came back to find that they'd had a brilliant time in London. And everyone that had taken part had a good time and got audiences. So then we started thinking about how we could develop that into something else. Wow. Bigger.
And so what did that look like when you guys decided to kind of make the break and lead the etc.? How did the Fringe carry on without being kind of based in a venue?
So by the time we left the etc., we were probably 3 or 4 years into Camden Fringe. And it was fairly well established then. We had quite a few venues, probably 5 venues in Camden that were happy to be part of it. And I think most of them still are, actually. Like, so Camden People's Theatre, upstairs at the Gatehouse, Camden Head, and they've all been regular participants ever since. And I mean, we couldn't run the etc. forever. You get a bit jaded after 8 years. It's mainly running the festival. It sounds like it's a very artistic and exciting thing to do, but it is mainly admin, and right, that can be right. done from a laptop kind of anywhere,
from
really
anywhere, yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of how we've ended up doing it, but it's always nice to go back and go and watch some shows and dip your toe in a bit,
definitely, without lugging cans of black paint up and down the stairs.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, I haven't painted a floor black for many years, which is a delight.
Oh god,
yeah, you must have been through a fair few cans of that.
Oh.
How do you think Camden Fringe differs from other Fringe festivals? Kind of what sets it apart?
It's very sort of homemade, I think. That's what my opinion is.
Yeah, quite homemade, quite short runs. People do short runs, and I think people can be quite experimental with what they're doing, which sometimes is great and sometimes is, you know, oh my God, what have I just seen? but I think people can still make quite a few mistakes. It's, you know, which I think is good. I think you need that testing ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I hope that we can continue to try and keep costs as low as possible so that people can keep making mistakes, because that's what we need, really.
Well, later on, I'm going to be talking to 2 playwrights bringing work to the Fringe this year, one from Singapore, another a Mexican writer based in the UK, both at different stages in their careers. One's a recent graduate and the other a teaching artist. Is that quite typical of the breadth of theatre makers that you see bringing work to the festival?
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we have a lot of quite young companies come and do Camden Fringe. You see a lot that are doing projects that they perhaps put together for their final year at university, and then they're like, right, this has got a life beyond doing it for an exam, let's get it out there and let's put it on for our families and friends and try and get some members of the public to see it and get the press to see it. But then you also have quite a lot of older people who've had careers and had lives and gone, actually, what I'd really like to do, what I always wanted to do, was put on a play, and this gives them the opportunity to do that, which is really lovely. And we do get quite a lot of people from all over the world coming to do it. And I think one thing that's definitely changed since we started the Camden Fringe is, realistically, 18 years ago when it started, people could live in London, which now property prices are such that it's really difficult for people who are doing anything artistic and not incredibly well paid and creative. Yeah, they can't afford to live in London. So we get many more acts coming from out of town to come and perform these days.
Which segues beautifully into the first of 2 conversations I had with writers bringing work to the festival this year. Pavan Jaisingh is a theatre artist and educator with over 2 decades of experience. He currently teaches at LaSalle College of the Arts in Singapore, and Pavan will be presenting his play Refuge at the Camden Fringe in August. Pavan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Maybe you can kick off by telling us a bit about the play.
So the play is titled Refuge, and in the past, whenever there was a refugee crisis, it was always somewhere in the Middle East or in Europe or somewhere that was quite far away from where I was. And I'm in Singapore, and you know, the countries around this region, Southeast Asia, all were like, oh, telling all these other countries, you should help these refugees, etc., etc. But then it ended up on our doorstep, where people from Myanmar were experiencing ethnic cleansing. And then that resulted in refugees getting onto a boat and traveling down the Straits of Malacca. And suddenly you had Malaysia and Indonesia and Singapore who now are facing the same question. Who's going to take in these refugees? And every single country was like, oh, no, there's just no space for us. you know, we have, there's no room for us. And even people close to me, family members were like, yeah, we can't take in these refugees. And I'm like, but why? What's the issue? I said, oh, there's no space. They'll come in and they will disrupt our culture, or they will be a burden on our system, or etc. And so what I wanted to do was to write something where the audience would understand that these people are just like us. Yeah, they might have cultural differences in terms of, you know, the food we eat, the ceremonies we attend. But at the end of the day, people are people. So I started reading some of these refugee stories. I wanted to find out about their humanity. What was their everyday lives like? So Refuge ended up being an amalgamation of all these stories. The first part being from the point the main character's home starts getting bombed. He's a simple shopkeeper. He doesn't keep up with the politics of the country. He's just an everyday shopkeeper. And so that first part of the play is about him running, taking his family and running. And then the second part is like flashbacks in time. And these are the moments that everyone understands and relates to. This person met his wife at a little marketplace. There was a little bit of flirting, exchanging of phone numbers. You can totally relate to that. And he talks about his children, the games the kids used to play, how he used to mark their heights as they grew taller in the kitchen, you know, with a little pencil, things like that. And these are the parts that I wanted everyone to understand. Look, they're just like you and me, right? And it's just that they are in these dire circumstances and we're not, you know. And I wanted to answer that question, like I said earlier, you know, why don't these people stay and fight?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a really strong central question, I think. Central dramatic question, why don't they stay and fight?
It's such a ridiculous, westernized Hollywood idea that, you know, there's nothing we can do. If bombs start landing in your home country and tanks start rolling in, there's nothing you're going to do about it. And let me tell you, like, I want to keep this piece quite timeless. I wrote this in 2016 and I've had audiences come up and say, oh yeah, this is a play about this place and this time. And then this is a play about this place and this time. And when I did it in Los Angeles, there were people coming up to me and go, oh, this is a play about that thing that happened last year.
It's a tragic reality, right?
Yeah, it's always going to be relevant because this problem just doesn't go away.
The second writer joining me in conversation is Valeria Suaste, a graduate of the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. Valeria has written several short films and is currently pursuing an MA in creative writing at the University of Surrey. Welcome, Valeria. Mm-hmm. Your play, Nymphomaniac Anonymous, debuted at the Etc. Theatre earlier in the year, mm-hmm. and will enjoy a second outing as part of the Camden Fringe at the Hen and Chickens Theatre. Can you tell us about the play?
Yes. So I'd seen the series called This Is Us. There's a scene somewhere in which one of the triplets, she's going to this support group for people that have issues with their self-esteem, more specifically about their bodies and those sort of things. So in the meeting, most of the people going to that meeting were overweight, except for this one girl who was just like this tiny woman, petite, you know, skinny, that you'd look at her and you'd be like, what? You're beautiful. Why are you here? You know? So in the series, that created a lot of tension between those two characters because the woman that was a triplet just was feeling very resentful towards her because she just didn't see why she would need to be there. From that and my general imagination and just my personal thoughts and things like that, I thought it would be kind of funny or just a way to sort of subvert that situation or talk about things that are important to me if it was actually a group of sex addicts and there was this girl who was going to these meetings with the purpose of finding someone to have sex with because she's a virgin and she figures that, you know, they're sex addicts. They know what they're doing. So it's not as scary.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking a lot about all of these sort of things and the stigmas and the criticisms that are happening. I think yesterday, I read Rebel Wilson, who was saying that was coming out publicly, which in my opinion, I don't think it's anyone's business whether at what age you lost your virginity.
Right.
Or whether you're a sex addict or not. I mean, the play, it's obviously about these sort of things, but it's fine. I think it's about finding connection, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the play in itself, you know, it's has five characters. One is the person that opens up the meetings. I wanted to choose someone that was non-binary because I thought that it might bring some balance to the play. And so they're a sex addict and through their healing journey of recovery. They start studying sex addiction in hopes of becoming a sex therapist, and they're very much about wanting to help people the way that they were helped. So they open up a new sex addicts anonymous meetings in the area. And four people show up, and the play happens throughout like 7-ish meetings throughout 7 weeks, and things happen outside of the meetings that come into the meetings. So yeah, basically that's what.
Okay, interesting, interesting. Is this the first piece that you'd written? The first full length piece?
It's my first full length piece, yeah, which I'm also like very, very proud of, because yeah. I've never really written something of this length.
Absolutely. Two really exciting plays there from Pavan and Valeria. I wanted to ask them to back up a little bit and talk us through the development journeys of their plays.
So my initial version was actually an hour and a half long. And there were multiple characters, and the characters would talk to each other. And my training is as an actor, and playing multiple roles, you know, is something that we all love doing. I had a bit of a reading. I had some friends get together, and they gave me a couple of notes. The initial feedback I got was that there was too much unnecessary acting, acrobatics going on, which I suppose was fair, because you know it started becoming a bit indulgent in that rather than the story itself. But I still performed that piece to small audiences.
And were you working with a director at this point, or were you self-directing this?
No. I self-directed. I acted. I produced it. I did everything.
Okay.
And then I was invited by my arts college to do it again at an alumni festival that they were putting up. And I got some of the same feedback, which was like, I think there's just too many characters, and you playing all those characters was a bit challenging. So fine-tuning it really depended on this one issue which I had, which is having multiple characters and playing multiple characters. And so that resulted in me having two choices. One, I could turn it into a three-person play.
Sure.
But potentially it could be a lot more interesting.
Yeah.
Or figuring out how to change the dialogue to keep it as a one-person play, but simplify some of the dialogue. So every time a new character came in, they would respond to the protagonist, and the protagonist would respond to them in longer sentences and paragraphs.
Okay. So less back and forth.
Yeah.
Were there solo shows that you'd watched or read at the time, plays like perhaps like Fleabag, for instance, that had inspired you?
Yes, actually one of the main productions that I was inspired by, who you might be familiar with, is actually a New Zealand-based Jacob Rajan.
Oh, Indian Ink. Yes, Indian Ink.
Yeah. They came to Singapore with a play called Guru of Chai. And it was a one-person show, and Jacob Rajan is the lead, and he performed this show so phenomenally well. Like
he's amazing.
Yeah, he told this very long story, and you know, he does a lot of mask work and I think clown work.
Yeah.
He changes characters by really modifying his face a little bit. And it was just the most captivating thing. And one of the main things I took away from him is his use of humor, of just playing, really just playing in the space. Like there's a moment in one of his shows where his character gets shot, you know, with a gun. And he does this thing where he takes his finger and he goes, and it's like pulling his finger, wee, he makes a sound, wee, going through the air. And then his own finger is like holding the bullet going through him and passing through him. And it's just the most amazing thing. And he uses like toys and things like that. And
brilliant.
Just simple things like that really blew me away. And I think that was one of the main inspirations I had.
So in that moment, you saw perhaps a way to reimagine the shape and form as a solo piece and what you could do with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then I took a break for a little while. And then last year, I took it to Los Angeles. And when I decided to take it to Los Angeles, that's where I decided to cut it down to an hour. Because when I wrote that hour and a half piece, no one told me that Fringe festivals prefer hour-long shows.
Sure,
I had this hour and a half piece, and I was like, oh, I'm so ready to take this to Fringe festivals. And people were like, yeah, but it's going to be hard when you... Because they just want one-hour pieces. I said, what? I wish someone had told me that before.
That's an interesting consideration, actually, for anybody listening, thinking about doing that, because obviously, you know, Fringe festivals, people want to see multiple shows throughout the day at you know, varying time slots. We're not talking about always traditional 7:30, whatever performances. You know, there are shows that could start at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And being able to fit within that time slot is critical because, of course, you'll be sharing, you know, your venue with multiple other companies.
Yeah. Keep it under an hour. In fact, 45 minutes would be great because that gives you more time to bump in and bump out.
Yeah,
because you will be sharing the space. You won't have a lot of opportunity to change lights and all that. In fact, you probably won't have any opportunity to change fixed lights and all that. And you'll only be allowed one rehearsal probably. So when I went to Los Angeles, I had a fantastic stage manager named Pam, who, you know, during a rehearsal of my piece, for example, there's a moment where the protagonist is now on a boat trying to escape and it gets searched by Coast Guards. And she was like, oh, you know what? I've got this great flashlight and I can use this flashlight as a Coast Guard flashlight. Do you want me to try it? I was like, you know what? Yes, go ahead, try it, right? And the only time that you could try it was during a performance, right? So if it didn't work, it was just not going to work. But I suppose a lesson that I would love to impart with regard to that is that, you know, the thing about fringe festivals, I mean, I tell this to all my students. I also teach at LaSalle College of the Arts now. The audience is always on your side, right? So if something isn't working, but you still commit to it, it's fine. It's fine. It's not disastrous. There's nothing to be angry about. And it goes back into this idea of theater being a collaborative medium, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The stage manager tries it. It really works. And I kept it for the rest of the show.
I love that. Isn't it great what you discover along the way?
So the first draft was not good. I did an R&D with it. It was barely a play. It was barely something. Like, I don't ever want anyone else to read that ever because it's so bad.
Okay.
But I gathered a group of friends and we did an R&D. I explained to them what the plot was, what each of their characters were. We did a couple of improvs with it, with the information that I gave them. Then we did a read of the draft. It was an entire day sort of thing. It was something from 10 to 5.
Yeah.
After that, I basically rewrote the play. So originally what was happening is that the entire play was going to happen throughout just a single session. Considering the character arcs, it just didn't make sense.
There's no space for development in that.
They're exactly. Yeah. Like, characters can't have realizations.
Yeah.
They can't grow. So I decided to basically break it up. And the second draft was basically a collage of that first draft. So I grabbed things and I put, oh, this might be good at the beginning, or this might be good more towards like the seventh session. And I expanded from that.
That's interesting.
That's why I went from like 50 minutes to like 2 hours.
Okay.
After that second draft, I had a reading again with the same actors. I asked them if we could just do a reading so I could hear it. Took some notes, did another draft, asked a friend if he could have a read of it and if he could give me some feedback on the play. We sat down in a cafe and he just started asking me questions about the characters and just like, oh, this character seems kind of flat, or like, why is this character here? So like 2 weeks before opening night, I was back in the writer's room and just reworking some scenes. Nothing got like completely rewritten, you know, but I did had to move some things around in order to make it better,
yeah.
You know?
Definitely. Well, it sounds like that first outing at the Etc. was invaluable in terms of discoveries and learning about the play.
Yeah.
So much so that you wanted to bring it back in August to the Camden Fringe Festival. Mm-hmm. What was the main driver behind that?
The people that I met that worked on the play just ended up really believing in it. People were like, oh, you have to take it further. You can't just let it die here, you know. And they convinced me.
Okay.
They convinced me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have that breathing time between now and then as well, so that you can relax a little bit. Now you've had it on its feet. You've seen it in front of an audience. You've now got the benefit of time to make final revisions and tweaks. What do you think your main goals and objectives are for your run at the Camden Fringe?
I'm not saying that this play is like going to be something huge and it's still going to be performed in like 50 years or whatever, you know. I just want to see what else is out there and have some, in some sense, try and have some hopes for the play, you know, because I didn't really have that many hopes when I first began the process. But like, as I started talking to people and they started putting on their hope in me, and now I just find myself sort of daydreaming about the possibilities of, yeah.
So Pavan, initial tryouts in Singapore, you took the play to LA, California to Camden. How, when and why did the Camden Fringe come onto your radar?
So I tried submitting it in Singapore a couple of times, got rejected. And then there's also one in Penang in Malaysia called the Georgetown Festival. I submitted it there, got rejected. And I was trying so hard to find the London Fringe Festival. And I kept Googling London Fringe Festival. And there is no London Fringe Festival. And then I had people who were like, oh, it's probably because, you know, London is a theater town. They don't need a fringe festival.
Yeah.
So I didn't know there was one called the Camden Fringe Festival. And, you know, everywhere in the world, there's some kind of fringe festival that's not curated that you can apply to. And then what happened for me was I just had a paradigm shift in my head. Like every year I tend to travel, want to go to a city and things like that. And I'm at a point now where, you know, I don't want to just travel and as a tourist. I want to travel as a theater artist. So I was going to spend this money anyway on a holiday. So now within that holiday, I'm going to squeeze in this theater production, this theater piece.
Fantastic.
And it becomes so, it's just become so much more fulfilling.
Yeah.
I went to Los Angeles. If I had gone on a holiday, it would have just been me checking out the sites, taking a studio tour or whatever. But this time when I went, I met other artists. You know, I sat down, we talked about what's it like working there. I got a feel of like, oh, did I want to do more stuff here? I met, you know, eccentric characters, as you will, when you go to theater festivals. And you see a different side of the community or the city that you wouldn't have seen if you were just a tourist.
London is such a vibrant place for artists. Throughout this first run, I've met so many people through it, and I just feel like Camden Fringe might be a great place to meet more people.
I'm really looking forward to going to Camden, and I feel like I'm gonna see a completely different side of it because I'm gonna be mixing with a whole different group of people, different characters you're gonna meet. So just having that paradigm shift on my end now suddenly it's just like, oh yeah, I can work this out. It's not a problem.
The buzz and excitement on the ground during any Fringe Festival is palpable, and I wanted to ask Michelle what visitors to Camden in August can expect in terms of that sense of community between venues and artists.
Yeah, I think some of the venues really foster a community feeling. I think the Lion and Unicorn in particular do days ahead of the Camden Fringe where you meet up with all the other shows. And we have like a launch party where we try and get as many of the acts down to come down and introduce themselves to each other and make friends. And then it's really nice to see in the days after that they're all very enthusiastically tweeting and putting on Instagram who they met and what shows they're looking forward to seeing. And we also offer kind of company passes to people taking part in the Camden Fringe so they can, if there's space, if the show hasn't sold out, they can sneak in and watch the shows. Because we really want, I think that's a really important part. If you're putting on plays for the first time, don't do things in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Go out and meet other people, go and see other shows, go to venues, and try and build yourself a little community. Don't just kind of keep your head down and carry on with just your show. Find other people to share it with, share ideas about marketing, share ideas about, you know, where you're getting your flyers from. Yeah, I think it's easy to picture a writer sitting on their own in a garret, coughing up blood into a handkerchief. But actually what they should be doing is going out and making friends and carousing a bit more, I think.
Yeah, and especially if you've only got, if you're only doing three or four performances, you could then spend the rest of the month with your pass going around all the other venues and just seeing loads and loads of stuff. And when you think how much it costs to, you know, book a ticket for a West End show, it's, you know, it's like gold, really, I think. I mean, not everything you see you're going to love, but there's something to be said for watching something and thinking, oh, I would never do that. That doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the beauty of Fringe Theatre, right? And an accessible price point as well, that you can, you know, take a chance on a show.
Yeah, definitely. One of the joys of being sort of backstage at the Camden Fringe is looking at people who've booked tickets, and you can see there are certain people who've just randomly gone, right, I've booked five shows on that day, or that weekend I'm going to go here and here and see those shows. And there's kind of, you go, oh, I wonder what their criteria was, but there's no connection between what they're booking. They've just kind of gone, right, well, like, look at that. I'll go and see that, or that fits in with my timing, and I'll pop in and see that one. That venue's on the way to that venue, so I can go and I can squeeze in another show there. And I'd absolutely love looking at that and seeing people who've just really embraced the the Fringe vibe, and they're not just going to see their friends play. They're going to go, yeah, I'll just go and have a look at that. And they've probably seen four or five shows for the price of going to see cabaret in the West End or something.
Yeah. And isn't that the beauty of pub theatre as well, that sometimes there's just a captive audience in the pub who maybe hadn't even realised there's a show on upstairs and just kind of stumble in. I remember doing shows at the Broccoli Jack, and half the time it felt like the audience were made up of whoever was kind of like the stragglers at the end of the night that were just stumbled into the theatre.
Yeah, there's always a slight danger of those people that hang around a pub a lot.
But there is something really special about a theatre happening in a pub, really. It's quite a wonderful thing. And to be able to just go in and sit there quite casually, you don't have to worry about getting dressed up. You can sit there with your pint, watch the show, and then come out and then see the actors afterwards and say, oh, you know, we loved that, and give them like instant feedback. You know, where else does that really happen? And I think it is pretty magical, really.
I love that. You go, you know, people go for one drink after work and then think, rather than schlepping home on the tube, you know, stay and see a show. It is beautiful. It is, in that, yeah, there's something about being part of that whole, everything that goes with Fringe Theatre, it's kind of, it's real community, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
The conversation continues after these messages. The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
So, Zina, Pavan already touched on the idea of Camden being an uncurated festival, in that sense, very accessible. What would have been the barriers that writers like him and Valeria would have faced in terms of getting their work on stage on an artistic level?
So for them to get sort of through our process, it's pretty simple, really. They fill out a form and the venues will receive this form, and then they can look at it, read a bit of blurb about the show, what it's about, read a little bit about the company and what this person has done in the past. And then the venue will make a judgment as to, does this person sound competent, like they will be nice to work with, and like they have a proper idea of what they're going to do, and do they sound like they're actually going to do this? Those are the things, really, that you wouldn't need a full script to get into the Camden Fringe. I think a lot of people don't have one until the last minute, if ever.
Okay. So if for anybody kind of working with a first draft right now, thinking about, you know, trying this out in front of an audience for the first time, a couple of nights at the Hen and Chickens is absolutely a viable option.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the more supporting material you've got, the better.
Yeah, definitely.
If you have got videos or if you've got photographs, like having something visual that the venues can look at, that definitely helps, but it's not required, because that's something we would help them get together as the process goes along.
And having the festival as a deadline is a really good way of actually completing the project.
Yeah, definitely. We all need a deadline.
Definitely.
Okay, so Valeria, producer hat on, writing aside, in terms of the steps involved in bringing your play to the stage, how have you found the self-producing journey?
Stressful. Okay. Stressful. I've done some short films before, so I was not that, like, producing wasn't really a stranger for me. But I'd never really produced theater before, so I was kind of like mentally prepared for the surprises.
So how many venues did you apply to?
Four. We applied to four.
And had you seen work in all those spaces before to think that they might be the right space for you, or were you just taking a chance based on what you'd found online?
We were taking a chance. We applied to the Etc. Theatre as well, because we did like performing in that venue. In the end, we ended up going with Hen and Chickens because it's slightly bigger. So we thought we might be a bit more, we might be able to bring in more people. They, like the people there were absolutely lovely. They told us that we could come by, see the theater, ask more questions. So we went by, we saw the theater, we had a tour, talked to the guy. So it was really lovely. And they were like, they were very supportive and seemed very excited to be doing Fringe.
Okay, let's talk budget. There's no end to how much you can spend on staging a show. And the budget for every show will vary massively. But Michelle, can you shed any light on perhaps some of the biggest costs involved in bringing your show to Camden?
So your biggest cost will be the venue, and they really vary. We have some venues that, I mean, you can go into Camden, find a pub that has a function room above it and say, can I use it on this date? And they might let you do it for free or for a very small amount of money. And then we've got up to venues that are quite established venues that are purpose built, and they will charge a few hundred quid for a performance. So it kind of, that's where you need to start. You can do it super cheap, but yeah, if you want a nice venue that's going to look after you, give you some technical backing, then you're going to have to pay for it. But they really vary in the deals that they do, so it's really hard to give a ballpark figure. But I would say maybe put 500 quid aside for your venue, and then have a look at how many nights you'll get out of that.
Yeah, it really depends on what you need and how you want it all to look. It is very difficult to put a figure on it.
So Pavan, in terms of bringing your suitcase show to a venue like the Etc.,
yeah,
could you talk us through some of your key expenses?
Yeah, so I'm performing four shows, and it's come up to £790 for me, which admittedly is expensive, but that's because of the choice I made. Etc. Theatre is where it all started, where Camden Fringe Festival started. But the value that I'm getting from working with Etc., first of all, I chose some pretty prime spots. I chose my first show is at 9 p.m. My second show is 3 p.m. on a Sunday. My fourth show is 7 p.m. on a Saturday. And my last show is again 3 p.m. So these are prime spots, which you don't have to take. You can take other slots that are cheaper. But I wanted the prime spots. Sure. I wanted to invest in it because I really want to go to London and explore further opportunities. Secondly, I knew in London that I would be able to sell. Even though I'm not going to walk away with a massive profit by any means, but I knew I'd be able to sell and cover most of my cost. And when you sign up with Etc. Theatre, there's just a number of things that they share with you in terms of like email contacts with reviewers. The email that I received from them once I signed on with all the help and assistance was really tremendous. It was totally worth the amount that I paid. Having said that, if you feel that it's too expensive or what, I found venues that were going for like £40 a slot, that were going for £50 a slot, which is really cheap, really reasonable in terms of its pricing.
Fantastic.
And so even selling my tickets at £10 and £7 per session, I'll still make most of my money back, I think.
Quite often, some of the venues will offer box office split arrangements for the rest of the year. Do you find venues willing to offer the same kind of arrangements during the Camden Fringe?
Some of them do. They all charge really differently, and some of them will charge a rental. If you're a company that they know, they might do you a deal or do a split. Or if it's like a particular time of day, they can't get anybody booked into that slot, you might be able to squeeze a deal out of them. What I'd say is, if you're unsure about times, dates, venues, anything that you've been offered, just ask us, and we'll give you our opinion on it. You know, because you might find that doing a show in an afternoon is a lot cheaper than getting a 7 or 9 o'clock evening slot. And we do find that afternoon shows do really well, although people are often a bit scared of doing them because they think people want to just see stuff at night.
And not just on the weekend afternoon shows, you find matinees midweek as well? Or
yeah, they can work quite well.
Yeah, because London is absolutely chock-a-block full of people.
Yeah, not everyone's doing a 9 to 5.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that is a bit different during Camden is that the venues will often have more shows on during a day than they would the rest of the year. They might, you know, year round have one show on an evening, and during Camden they'll have two, or a few of the venues will have up to 5 shows during the day, which is then that makes it cheaper for people to hire, but they do have less time to get in and out. So you have to be aware that you don't have a big set because you're not going to have time to get that in and out.
Right.
Every day, but you know, cuts down your costs as well.
Yeah, or do have a big set, but have a big team of people that can move it for you and just be prepared for that. And also, some venues offer box office staff and front of house staff, and some don't. So you might need to, you know, bring your mum along to collect tickets or whatever. So just ask all of the questions that you have of the venue.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of registering to be part of the Fringe itself, what's the cost there?
We charge a £99 registration fee. You can pay more if you would like to be in a printed brochure. Whether the printed brochure makes much difference, I don't know, but it is a little way of us, you know, eking out a living from doing this.
Yeah, it's less effective than it used to be, isn't it?
Definitely,
print is definitely on the way out.
Yeah, and your brochures are circulated within all of the participating venues.
Yeah, and throughout other London venues as well.
Brilliant. So let's look at marketing strategies that are most effective then, perhaps, and where time and money is best spent. I imagine being in the Camden Fringe brochure alone is not enough.
You need to have a think, right, well, I've got these many Facebook followers, I'm going to make videos, I'm going to go out on the street and give out flyers. Think about how you're actually going to reach people.
Yeah.
Because that is important. There's no point writing stuff if no one's going to come and see it.
Yeah. Think about what the theme of your show is and who that's going to particularly appeal to. So Michelle really likes running. So if somebody was doing a show about running, Michelle might want to go and watch that show if she knew it was happening. So think about how you would reach her.
Brilliant.
Because there's so many little niche groups on the internet now for different things. You can find them, but you just have to be quite targeted.
Yeah. Targeted marketing in terms of, like, you know, flyering in a city like Edinburgh when you have a captive audience who are perhaps there for the festival. Do you find somewhere more transient like London, flyering is probably less effective than, you know, setting a small budget for digital marketing and being targeted that way?
Yeah, definitely. Flyering is not the most effective way to do it. In Camden, our venues are sort of spread through all North London, really. And so there isn't just people that are just turning up to see the Fringe stuff. Obviously, by all means, have flyers and put them in your venue. Ask other acts if you can give them out after their shows. If you found a show that's quite similar theme to yours and you think will appeal to a similar audience.
That's good. Yeah.
You know, ask if you can put flyers on the seats or give them out afterwards and put them in people's hands who've been to see that show. But otherwise, yeah, digital marketing is definitely the way forward. With your time and money.
Yeah, you're more likely to reach a useful person.
I asked Pavan and Valeria about their plans for marketing their plays.
Again, with the tremendous help that came with working with etc., they've already sent me, if you want to print flyers, etc., just send it to us and we'll put it up where it's supposed to go. And really, in terms of spend, that's probably about it. Just those flyers and maybe a couple of posters. Posters will cost like £2-3, £10 or whatever it is. Mostly it's now digital posters because everybody's got screens. So you just need to create a digital poster. You don't really need that much printable cost stuff anymore. Now it's all online. It's all digital.
In terms of targeted marketing, will you spend anything on social media campaigns?
Yeah. I will go on Facebook and I will spend maybe $50 sing.
Sure.
To put up an ad, I'll go on, and then it goes across platforms. It goes across to Instagram, which is actually the main one. Instagram is more popular than anything else.
Yeah.
What we did last time, we did a couple of Instagram and Facebook ads for it, which did bring in a lot of interaction with the play. We had a lot of people, some people start following the account and things like that. To be honest, I don't know what worked from that strategy. Maybe because we've already have sourced most of the props and the set, we might actually end up putting a bit more money into marketing and a bit more into Instagram and Facebook ads. We also found that on Instagram, doing reels,
right,
for some reason, people really like watching reels. So
okay,
we got a lot of people interact with the account that way.
I don't have a fixed budget per se, because if I come up with this fixed budget and something, a good opportunity comes along and I go, oh, it doesn't fit my budget, I run the risk of going, nah, I won't do it, and then feel bad about it. So I always ask myself when an expense comes along, is this something I can afford? Yes. Okay, just spend the money. Just spend the money. Don't worry too much. It goes back to that paradigm of, like, why are you doing this festival? How badly do you want it? And it might be a different approach to other artists, and I fully respect that, but this is something that's worked for me.
No one's expecting to, you know, to get rich quick on the Fringe or even to make a profit. I mean, breaking even would be nice, I think, half the time. What do you think, aside from monetary rewards, what would you say are some of the biggest takeaways from being involved in something like the Camden Fringe?
It's all about learning how to put your own work on, really, and not waiting around for someone, you know, to phone you up and say, hey, I've got this opportunity for you, because on that just doesn't really happen, does it? Unless you're somebody who's already really famous.
One thing that I think is has developed really nicely for the Camden Fringe is the press support that we get. We have a really nice group of London or UK-based bloggers and review sites that will come and see stuff. And if you contact them, even if you're only doing three nights, they will quite often try and come and see your show if it sounds interesting. So you can definitely get a nice set of reviews out. We have awards that are based around the Camden Fringe. So London Pub Theatres do a Standing Ovation Award, which actually that's not based around the Camden Fringe, but they will see Camden Fringe shows for it. And then there's the Offies. They have an Off Fest category, which is for shows taking part in short festivals, and there is a Camden Fringe leg of that. So you can, get some stuff out of it that will push your show along and help you get more bookings in the future for it, or, you know, help you develop it further in the future. So that's definitely a benefit. And then also just being part of a festival, seeing other shows, meeting other people and developing your network.
Yeah, I think taking away some reviews and some good production photography can be really useful for the next thing. Theatre, especially fringe theatre, doesn't always film very well, but you can get some really good production shots, I think.
Definitely. We've done an interview recently with one of the shows that's coming up at the Camden Fringe this year. They won an award for basically filming their show. They hadn't done anything complicated. They basically filmed it. It had been on for four nights and they'd filmed it from a different angle each night. And then they put together a very simple video of the show, and that got the show out to a wider audience as well. So there is always that option to film it. But I think, yes, photos are really, really important, definitely worth investing a bit of time and money in.
So Pavan, what will a successful run at the Camden Fringe look like for you?
A couple of reviewers would be great, but I want other producers to come and watch it, to see it and go like, hey, and then perhaps let's talk about, can I take this to other places? Can I take it to Edinburgh? Can I take it to other fringe festivals, things like that. Someone to recognize it as, you know, this is something that can be taken to other places.
Michelle, do you find that people will generally bring a piece of new writing to the Camden Fringe as part of the development journey, a work in progress kind of showcase performance with a view to producing a longer 2 to 3 week run on the fringe beyond, perhaps?
Yeah, people definitely come and do just a few days. Loads of the shows are billed as work in progress. The nice thing is, being part of the fringe, you get to meet your venues, and lots of shows get invited back to come and do a longer run after they've done Camden Fringe, because they've got to know the venues. The venues have liked their show. They've had some nice reviews. And that's what we always say to people, is try and do a short run. People quite often get ambitious and go, I want to do my show 15 times across 3 venues. And you're like, no, hold back on that. Maybe do it 3 times, 5 times in one venue. And then if it's good and it works, then you've got time to go away, polish it and bring it back. And that venue will invite you back if your show's good quality and you get a good audience in. And it's always better to sell out a show and create that demand and put it on again than kind of have half quarter empty venues and sort of limp your way through it. So yeah, rein back your ambitions a little bit in terms of how many tickets you think you can sell to begin with, I think is probably a good bit of advice.
So Valeria, you've seen your piece on stage already at the Etc. What will a successful run at the Hen and Chickens look like for you in August?
Well, after having this initial run back in February, I've reassessed a lot of what having a successful show means to me. I just feel like I would have a successful show if I had some audience members leave with their thinking cap on. Or maybe even if you don't leave with your thinking cap on and just leave like, haha, I had fun, you know, then
have fun.
Yeah. You don't have to watch a theater show and leave like, oh, trauma. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Just enjoy.
So Pavan, what would you say to any writers considering bringing a new piece of writing to a fringe festival completely off their own backs, backing themselves?
Once you get a lot of good feedback from people you trust, as well as maybe a stranger or two, and you yourself have a gut feel, you've got to have a gut feel that this is an interesting show that people want to watch. The simple answer is, yeah, do it. Just do it. Yes, it's going to make a little bit of a hole in your wallet, but it's all very worth it. And it's only that first time that's daunting. After that, it's like, right now, the Camden Fringe that's coming up, I'm very relaxed about it. I'm not worried about anything because I know what I'm going to expect. and I'm ready to roll with the punches and ready to roll with it and really just go for it.
I love that.
Just do it, you know, like it's terrifying. I'm not gonna lie. It's super terrifying to, you know, have that first draft and have people read it and be like, and then after they read it, you sit there and think like, oh my God, that was trash. Why did I let people read that? No, but you need to be brave. You know, you need to go put it out there, have people watch it and, you know, take a chance, because if you don't, you're really not going to get anywhere. That's the hard truth of art. If you don't show it to people, then it might as well not exist.
My theater teacher always said to me, like, go back to that first time when you wanted to create as a theater artist, as a writer and all that. Remember just how much fun it was. Everything else was just peripheral, right? If something happened, it's fine. How does it really affect your show? How does it really affect your work? What is it? It's performer and audience. They've never seen your script. They don't know what's right. They don't know what's wrong. If you keep committing to it, the show will always be what they expected, because they weren't expecting anything.
Yeah. That's really
you know what I mean?
That's really true.
Yeah. They've come to the theater. They're always on your side. They want to see it. Nobody's paid money to see you fail.
Definitely. That's a really good piece of advice. Pavan, Valeria, thank you so much for your time and for sharing each of your stories of bringing your plays to the festival.
No, thank you so much for having me. I love chatting about this.
Thanks so much for inviting me. It really is lovely. Thank you so much.
Okay, Zina, Michelle, so any writers out there interested in getting involved in the Camden Fringe and bringing a new piece of work, what's the first step?
Have a look at our website.
Yeah, definitely.
CamdenFringe.com. We take our applications through a system called Eventtron, which is a way that fringe theatres across the world, not every single one, but many of them, will take applications. So if you upload your details, upload your show on there, you can apply to the Camden Fringe, but you can also apply to, for example, Brighton Fringe, Greater Manchester Fringe. In the UK, quite a lot of the Edinburgh venues will use it as well. But also there's lots of fringe festivals across the world, loads in Canada, in Australia and New Zealand, who will also program using that system. So once you've got a really, you know, a show together and your idea, the world is your oyster.
Fantastic. So in terms of Eventtron, then I need to create a profile, probably have a synopsis for my show and maybe some artwork.
Yes. Yeah. That's all ideal.
Brilliant. And what about the timeline for applying? If anybody wants to get involved this year, is it too late?
As it's now May, it's getting a bit late, but absolutely not impossible. We can still accommodate people. So if they want to get involved this year, there will still be slots available at venues. People will drop out at the last minute, so you can hop in. And if you do find that it feels like it's too soon for you to put something on in August, then just come and get involved by seeing some shows and having a look at what else is on and seeing the venues and getting some ideas for next year.
Definitely. And when is it too early? When do you open for next year? If someone's thinking about an idea now, how soon can they start to do that?
We'll open applications probably around the 10th of January. But if they want to sort of get prepared before that, they can start their Eventtron profile at any point. So you can add yourself and just start working on your various bits and pieces and working on your blurb and your synopsis. So you're totally ready for it.
It'll be great to come and see stuff, like you said, this year with a view to coming yourself next year.
Yeah, you can decide what venues you like the look of and, you know,
yeah,
what feels right for you.
Definitely.
Brilliant. Lovely. Thank you guys so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your time.
Fantastic.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Cheers, guys. Stay well.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.
And Pavan's play Refuge plays at the Etc. Theatre from the 3rd to the 11th of August. And Valeria's play Nymphomaniac Anonymous is at the Hen and Chickens Theatre from the 15th to the 18th of August. Information about all the plays in this year's Camden Fringe Festival can be found at camdenfringe.com, where you can also check out the Camden Fringe podcast, a brilliant resource from Michelle and Zina about everything Camden Fringe and beyond. Some fantastic guests on there with lots and lots of brilliant resources and information to share.
Next time.
Join me next time when my guests will be Rachel Lynette and Mimi Collins, and we'll be exploring readings in their various guises and forms, the virtual, table, and staged varieties.
Back in like the 70s, right? 1970s American theater, where people wore their all black and they had the scripts in their hand and it was all minimalist theater. That's kind of the vibe we were going for, just virtually. But we made it very clear that people were reading it and it was still a production. And like, it was a conversation that we had to have, and I was thankful to have, of like, This is what theater kind of used to do. Like, theater companies used to go in bars and they would wear their cute little hats and they would switch hats when they were switching characters. Like, and that's my favorite kind of theater. And Zoom makes it really easy to do that.
I think it has to do with taking your work out of that vacuum, right? That as writers, you're so often in a room by yourself or with a cat. And so the more, I think the more factors you can bring in to your script, be that actor saying it out loud, be that an audience reacting, the stronger you're going to make it and the more you're going to learn. And I think the audience is a huge factor in knowing what the impact of your script is.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Writer's Toolkit podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave a review and share the link with your friends. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me A Coffee link in the show notes.